县城山又高，处处港口都显耀。
Hello and welcome to the very first episode of Strait Talk, where we dive deep into the Taiwan Strait, a major battleground between Western hegemony and Eastern resistance, giving you a fresh perspective on Taiwan, mainland China, and beyond, distinct from what is typically portrayed in mainstream media. I'm your host, Xiang Yu, and today we got my longtime friend Carl Zha, host of the Silk and Steel podcast, to come on and virtually and figuratively cut the ribbon for the show. So Carl, how are you doing?
Good, good. I have so we're preparing for our second child. I got a bum in the oven. That's coming in July. Yeah. So.
Oh, congratulations! Is it another son or a daughter?
It's another son. We're hoping for a daughter. My wife already made up the girl's name, but then. Yeah, anyways, that's fine. I mean,
yeah, so when I was planning this podcast, I was thinking of the best way to do the first episode. And I thought, since the seeds of this podcast were really planted on your show with our Taiwan History series, you'd be the perfect candidate to come on and help introduce the concepts behind the show and let my audience get to know me as well as you a little bit, since I have a feeling this won't be the last time you'll be on the show. But before we do that, why don't you introduce yourself to those who might not know who you are?
Hi, guys. I am Carl Zha. I'm a prolific shit poster on Twitter. I also run my own YouTube channel, Carl Zha, and I run the Silk and Steel podcast, where I talk about everything China, history, culture, and politics. It's on Patreon. Check it out. I'm doing a chronological retelling of the Chinese history from the very beginning. Well, now I am at 535 BC, so I have ways to go. Anyway, I got into doing what I do because, I grew up bicultural. I was born in China in 1976, right 1 month after Mao died. So I'm the first post-cultural revolution generation in China. I grew up in China in 1980s, and then I came to United States in 1990, right after the Tiananmen Square protest. So I went to eighth grade, high school, college in US. So I consider myself bilingual and bicultural. And I'm getting increasingly radicalized by the US mainstream media coverage of China. Because when I read news about China in the mainstream media, I feel like I'm reading about a China that exists in a bizarro world. It's nothing like the China I left behind, and it's nothing like the China I knew on my visit. So I felt like I'm obligated to share my own experience and my own perception of like the US-China relationship. And that's where I brought you on my show for the first time, because you are a very interesting character, Xiang Yu. You are you're Taiwanese. I mean, you are your family, sixth generation of your family had the roots in Taiwan on your mom's side. But you came to your parents came to U.S. You were born in U.S., but you maintain your tie to Taiwan because you grew up. You will go back. Your childhood, you grew up in Taiwan, right? Because your parents sent you back, or?
Yeah, so I am a Chinese citizen of the Taiwan area, and I have lived here for a few years continuously, and recently completed my 1 year conscription. And growing up, whenever I wasn't in school, I'd be here in Taiwan. And before I attended school, I'd be here for months at a time. Then, when I was a teenager, I began rapping in Chinese, not really expecting it to be anything more than a hobby. But my song spread in the underground hip-hop scene here, and that's how I ended up really developing social circles here. So yeah, I feel a very similar obligation to you, because I grew up really following what went on here in Taiwan, and I've seen changes throughout my life ever since the 1990s. I have similar thoughts on Western mainstream media's reports on China, including Taiwan, and have been equally frustrated with the general lack of accurate information. I mean, I get Taiwan is a small island that's in many ways insignificant, but as fate would have it, an insignificant place has become a significant geopolitical battleground, and the Taiwan Strait separating Taiwan from the Chinese mainland has become one of the front lines in the battle between Western hegemony and Eastern resistance, as well as dying unipolarity and rising multipolarity. So whether we like it or not, I mean, I certainly miss the days when very few people besides Chinese people knew where what Taiwan was. They just think, oh, it's Thailand. But we have to understand this region better in order to get a more complete picture of global politics. But the thing is, most people outside of China cannot speak on Taiwan without getting some of the most basic facts wrong. And this applies to both the pro and anti-China sides. And a lot of people have this understanding of Taiwan, I found, that begins in 1949, then jumps to the present day. And although cross-strait history and Taiwan's history are just small parts of broader Chinese history, there's still a lot more than meets the eye. And the more you know, the more you'll be equipped to interpret current events and not be misled by bad actors.
So let's face it, most of the Westerners are very, very ignorant about Taiwan or China in general. So when they talk about Taiwan or China, they're not really talking about the place as is. They're more talking about a projection from their head of what those places are. This is often the problem for like kind of the Western conversation around China. It's a foil for them to act, really talk about problems at home, talk about problems they're more familiar with, which is in the Western context. But they actually don't have real on the ground knowledge about the Eastern context. This is where we come in because, you know, we are, yeah, still pretty grounded in our culture.
And a lot of the English language voices that are based in Taiwan are essentially NGO funded and tell Westerners what the Western elites and what the administration here, which incidentally serves the Western elites, want the average Joe in the West to hear. Which is why when a lot of things are presented, they're entirely stripped of historical context.
I mean, for the deep historical dive, for the deep analysis of the historical context, people should listen to or watch our Taiwan history series on Silk and Steel podcast, which is like a 10, 11 episode long, over 10 hours, where we cover like from prehistory all the way to the present, all the political development, all the cultural development.
Yeah, I'll put the links in show notes.
Yeah, but for most people, when they talk about Taiwan, their knowledge start in 1949. Like Chiang Kai-shek fled mainland China to Taiwan. And that's for them where the history of Taiwan starts. But it actually goes, you know, way back. And it's a very simplistic way of portraying the political development in Taiwan, because that's your reference point. You know, Chiang Kai-shek leaving mainland China in 1949, you are getting a very narrow view of the Taiwan's actual historical relationship is mainly China, right?
It's kind of like when Tucker Carlson interviewed Putin and tried to ask about the context between, you know, Ukraine and Russia. And Putin goes back by over 1,000 years. And Tucker starts asking, wait, how is this relevant? And sure, the average viewer isn't going to remember all of the nitty-gritty details Putin went through in his short retelling of Russian history. But most viewers will finish watching the interview with at least a slightly better understanding of the situation and realize there's this deep history that goes way beyond 2022 when the military operation began, or 2014 when the Maidan coup happened, or 1991 when the Soviet Union was dissolved. Hopefully, after this episode, more people will realize that the current state of affairs between Taiwan and mainland China cannot be understood if our reference point is 1949, when the Communist Party took control of the mainland and established the People's Republic of China, or 1945, when Taiwan was returned to China following 50 years of Japanese colonization. And as they listen to more episodes that get deeper into all of this history, they'll be able to make more sense of what's going on and know how to be critical when Taiwan's being reported by mainstream media. I mean, to really understand Taiwan, we have to go, at the very least, all the way back to the Qing Dynasty. Anyways, I think one of the greatest misconceptions on the anti-China side is that Taiwan is an independent country.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what's the official name of the government on Taiwan, Xiang Yu?
According to the laws of the Taiwan administration, the Republic of China is the legitimate government of China, and Taiwan is a part of the Republic of China. And I think this gets into another misconception that people have, which is the belief that Taiwan was established by Chiang Kai-shek in 1949 as a separate country, or that he created a new country called the Republic of China in 1949, when the Republic of China was founded on the mainland in 1912, following the Wuchang Uprising in late 1911, and Taiwan has been the name of this island for 400 years. Anyways, from Chiang Kai-shek's perspective, Taiwan was his last stronghold that hadn't fallen to the communists, and the Republic of China continues to exist as a legitimate Chinese government, unless it's thoroughly defeated in Taiwan. And for a while, this perspective carried some weight because most of the Western powers continued to recognize the Republic of China as a legitimate Chinese government until the 1970s. However, from Beijing's perspective, enough of China was under their control to justify the creation of a new government called the People's Republic of China that can be declared the successor state of the Republic of China. And what continues to operate under the name of the Republic of China are remnants of a previous dynasty that operate as an internal renegade region, which has happened on multiple occasions in Chinese history.
I was in, I spent my teenage years in the Chicago Public Library, right? Because I was a nerd. And I remember they still have like magazines from
Free China Magazine.
Free China Magazines, which is basically a magazine published by the KMT government on Taiwan in like 1980s. It's pretty interesting. And I think all the way up to 1990, like when I was in Chicago, it was already 1990. They have these back catalogs of Free China Magazine all the way till like 1980s, 1970s. But it's actually just so about like publication in Taiwan about Taiwan. Yeah.
I think what people don't understand is whenever there is a new dynasty in China, remnants of the old ones will still exist for a while. I mean, when the Ming overthrew the Yuan, remnants of the Yuan still existed up north in what is now Mongolia and parts of Russia. And that existed up until the Qing Dynasty. And today that rump state is referred to as the Northern Yuan for ease of reference. But like from the perspective of the Yuan, they weren't like, oh, we're defeated. We're going to establish a new country called the Northern Yuan. No, they still call themselves like the Yuan Empire. It's just they kind of lost control of the rest of their empire. And the Ming certainly didn't recognize the Northern Yuan as a country. It's more like territory that's part of China, but not under Ming control. And that's a very similar situation of what we have today in a China that's not yet fully reunified. Except today we have institutions like the United Nations, and there's an issue of internationally recognized sovereign states. And we also have a Western-dominated world order interested in maintaining its geopolitical interests, and therefore have forces interested in preventing Chinese history from running its course, and want to maintain the division of China along the Taiwan Strait. However, at the same time, they want to maintain working relations with the Chinese mainland, so they won't outright support Taiwan separatism, but instead keep Taiwan separatists as attack dogs on a leash that can be loosened or tightened in their negotiations with mainland China. Taiwan separatists have this belief that all of Taiwan's problems would be solved if it dropped out from this game completely and dissolved the so-called Republic of China and established a new Republic of Taiwan with clear borders drawn between it and the rest of China. But the thing is, right now, separatists who have made it into the government operate under the so-called ROC's laws and derive their power from the so-called ROC's constitution. And on top of that, most people in Taiwan wish to maintain the status quo, so they are not really in a position to formally declare independence, even if they wanted to. And I guess this ties in with the next misrepresentation of Taiwan, this time on the pro-China side that I kind of want to get into. They had this idea that Taiwan was either a barren island or was mostly inhabited by indigenous people before the KMT came. So they'll assume, oh, Taiwan is 98% Han because the KMT committed genocide. And then to back this claim, they'll point to the 228 incident in 1947 to justify this claim. But the reality is Taiwan was already majority Han by the time the Japanese colonized Taiwan back in 1895 and was the result of centuries of migration from southern Fujian and to a lesser extent Hakka people from Guangdong, as well as aboriginal people in the plains areas of Taiwan assimilating into Han culture and adopting Han identity after centuries of cultural contact. So these people who were already on Taiwan by the time the KMT came are called Bensheng人, which means people of this province, as opposed to Waishengren, or people from outside of this province, which refers to people who arrived to Taiwan after 1945 or 49, as well as their descendants. Bensheng人 is sometimes translated to native Taiwanese, So when people look at the separatist account of the 228 incident that frames the tragedy as the massacre of Bensheng人 by KMT soldiers, they assume it was an indigenous genocide, when in reality, indigenous people weren't really involved at all. Not to mention, the 228 incident was far from the simple matter of 外省人 blindly killing 本省人, but was a tragedy that began when anti-contraband officers tried to confiscate illegal cigarettes from a vendor, which escalated into an altercation that resulted in a protest that was dispersed with shots into a crowd, which in turn led to riots sparking throughout the island during a time when people on Taiwan were already fed up with the KMT's rule. Remember, this was when the civil war was going on the mainland, so the KMT taxed Taiwanese people heavily to fund the war and left Taiwan in a very neglected state with high inflation. And after this incident broke out, unfortunately, you had some hooligans who were Bensheng人 looking for scapegoats for the bad situation and were going around randomly beating, murdering, and even raping 外省人. And on March 8th, reinforcements were sent in to Taiwan from the mainland to quell the riots, which resulted in more deaths on both sides. At the end of the day, the death toll for Bensheng人 and 外省人 were roughly equal and was nowhere near as high as the inflated numbers presented by separatists today. And this gets into demographic tensions on this island. And this gets into demographic tensions on this island of the past generation that often get overlooked by pro-China Westerners, who are sometimes guilty of lazily copying and pasting U.S. identity politics onto other parts of the world, which does not help them understand that the situation today is the result of many layers of contradictions being exacerbated by the global elites who wish to maintain their control over Taiwan. Kind of want to get into a fun fact, which I feel like a lot of people don't know, which is if you're a boomer and your dad came from the mainland, you weren't Taiwanese. Like, you wouldn't consider yourself Taiwanese, and people in Taiwan wouldn't consider you Taiwanese. You would be a 外省人 living in Taiwan.
I think the most famous example is the singer of that song that went viral on TikTok, you know.
Fei Yuqing.
雪花飘飘，北风萧萧. So the singer of that song, Fei Yuqing, and he is second generation. He was born in Taiwan, but his parents came from mainland. But he wouldn't be considered as like local Taiwanese by the local Taiwanese people, right? Because his parents was like migrant from mainland.
Growing up, he wouldn't have been considered Taiwanese, but now 外省人, especially third generation, are considered equally Taiwanese as their 本省 counterparts. I think this really follows Chinese logic, where when we ask, where are you from? 你是哪里人? We're not really asking you where you're born or where you grew up, but where your family's from. And centuries ago, when 本省人 first arrived to Taiwan, it's always the second or third generation that say they're from a location in Taiwan like Zhanghua or Tainan, whereas the first and second generations would say they're from wherever their family came from on the mainland, such as Zhangzhou, Quanzhou, or Meixian. Another misunderstanding I want to get into, again more on the pro-China side, and I guess I'm a bit more critical of pro-China people because I think if you're going to go around saying you're defending China, it behooves you as a Westerner to better understand one of the biggest issues between China and the West. Otherwise, you give the other side plenty of ammo.
Well, I think we are actually battling like the general ignorance on Taiwan, because this is the kind of the ignorance, what you say on both the pro-China side and the anti-China side, they're really just a reflection of the general ignorance on Taiwan, which is a lot. And because right now, in US in particular, the only way Taiwan is talked about is through the Cold War lens. It's in the Cold War context and or in the current Cold War climate of the US-China competition. They don't really talk about Taiwan as its own place, its own with its history, its and culture and political development and all that. Like what we did on our Taiwan history series. So go ahead. Whatever myth you want to dispel.
I definitely agree with what you're saying here. And the thing I wanted to mention is how a lot of pro-China Westerners like to paint Taiwan in general as the aggressor, when the people on Taiwan and the mainland alike are just caught up in a situation that we had no control over. I mean, my family on either side certainly had no say in any of this. And to be honest, the loudest voices in what is called the Taiwan lobby in America is very alien to Taiwan, despite playing the role of Taiwan's representatives in America, when in reality, they're just serving the interests of the globalists.
I think to make it sense for the American context, maybe you know, you can look at kind of all these foreign wars and aggression that U.S. government is committed around the globe. But a lot of the times, the American people actually have very little say in it, in the U.S. foreign policy, because their senators, you know, a lot of times American people don't even care about these far-flung places that can't find on a map. But it's their politicians for their own interest is doing this.
Why should they care? I mean, they elect their officials to fix problems at home, not cause problems abroad, or even fix problems abroad, which isn't really the case.
Yeah. But it's their politicians for their own interest is doing this. I think, and maybe like the American people are being misled, maybe they're being propagandized, but they themselves are not the drivers behind the American aggressions abroad. I think that applies to people in China and Taiwan as well.
Yeah, definitely. You do make a good point there. And from the results of the last election, with Lai winning only 40% of the vote, and less than 30 if we count those who abstained as well, people in Taiwan are frankly sick of being held hostage by these issues while they're not seeing their lives improve. Anyways, let's get into the next misunderstanding of Taiwan, which ties into the previous point of painting Taiwan, the island itself, along with its people as aggressors, which is the misunderstanding that Taiwan claims to be the real China and that it claims the mainland and Mongolia as its territory. What people don't understand is Taiwan is Taiwan. It's the name of this island. Nobody says the mainland is part of Taiwan, but the so-called Republic of China legally claims to be the legitimate Chinese government, and therefore its territorial claims include Taiwan, mainland China, as well as Outer Mongolia, though these claims today are not actively pursued. What I don't think people realize is that a huge part of Taiwan separatism seeks to remove mainland China from the so-called ROC's territorial claims. So if mainland China were removed from the constitutional map, then...
it's a move toward independence or separation.
Yeah. It would be the formalization of a two-China solution if the administration on Taiwan continues to operate as the so-called Republic of China. And it's outright separatism if it's done in conjunction with establishing a Republic of Taiwan. So it's seen as a step towards separatism regardless. So right now, with the People's Republic of China and the so-called Republic of China claiming more or less the same territory, it means issues between the two sides are a domestic matter, which is why cross-strait affairs are handled in Taiwan by the Mainland Affairs Council and on the mainland by the Taiwan Affairs Office as special domestic affairs and not foreign ones. Now, Mongolia is a funny case because Chiang Kai-shek signed a treaty with the Soviet Union that recognized Mongolian independence, but later on declared that treaty to be unequal and stopped recognizing Mongolian independence. Now, in practice, nobody today denies that Mongolia is a separate country, but removing it from the map sets a precedent for removing more territories from the map. So as you can see, the so-called Republic of China, in a way, is a story of reanimating a corpse with different spirits. The spirit was first the Chiang Kai-shek clique, and now it's separatists operating within the system. But in a way, this corpse is a failsafe with its laws and formalities that prevent the legal independence of Taiwan as long as it's not abolished. Anyways, the U.S. was founded when the 13 colonies were declared independent from British rule. And can you give me the date of the declaration?
1776.
July 4th, right?
Yeah, the Continental Congress, right? First Continental Congress.
Yeah, now give me the date that Taiwan established independence. You can't, because it never happened.
People will tell you Taiwan declared independence in 1911.
Which is funny, because 1911 was when the Qing Dynasty was overthrown, leading to the establishment of the Republic of China on January 1st, 1912. And back then, Taiwan was under Japanese colonization. And there was actually a wave of anti-Japanese protests by Chinese patriots on Taiwan, who were inspired by the establishment of a Chinese republic.
Well, there is now like a narrative coming from the separatist side that's saying, okay, well, Taiwan actually had, you know, you're right. Taiwan was never independent because Taiwan has always been governed by these various colonial regimes. And now they're equating like the Dutch, the Qing dynasty government, the Japanese, all as the same, all like colonizers of Taiwan, and KMT as all like colonizers of Taiwan. So they're saying, okay, Taiwan need to be decolonized. So how do you respond to that?
This is historical revisionism intended to spread historical nihilism as well as downplay actual colonialism and imperialism in the region. Taiwan's incorporation into Chinese civilization came as a result of a lot of these people's ancestors coming to Taiwan and spreading our civilizational culture here over the course of centuries. Whereas Taiwan's rule by the Dutch and Japanese were cases of outsiders ruling the local population as foreign powers. And whereas the struggle against the Dutch and Japanese were struggles against external colonizers, the struggle against the KMT is one against a domestic entity. Now, if we equate the spread of Chinese civilization as colonialism, then by this logic, every bit of China outside of the Central Plains region is a Chinese colony, meaning Beijing and Guangdong are Chinese colonies. Taiwan's population today is the result of Taiwan's incorporation into Chinese civilization, whereas Dutch and Japanese rule never really changed the demographic makeup or culture of Taiwan on a major scale. It's still Chinese culture in the main to this day, with little bits of influence from both, not unsimilar to how you have bits of French influence in Shanghai to this day or remnants of German influence in Shandong today. Not to mention, this civilizational expansion occurred long before the Westphalian system of modern states occurred, and ever since this global institution existed, Taiwan has been a part of China, with the exception of 50 years under Japanese occupation. And by the way, when the Japanese governed Taiwan, the people of Taiwan were considered Chinese by them. And to the people who say Taiwan was never a part of China, if that were the case, how come Japan had to conclude a treaty with China in 1895 to gain Taiwan as a colony?
It's historical revisionism, because after Japanese surrender in 1945, people in Taiwan actually went to line up on the docks to welcome the KMT troops to come to Taiwan to replace the Japanese colonial government. I mean, it's what happened afterwards, you know, due to misrule of KMT on Taiwan that led to, you know, growing resentment on, and all that. But in August 1945, people in Taiwan were happy that it was returned to China. They went to the docks to welcome the KMT troops from mainland to come in and to take over.
Yeah, that was 1945. But then between 1945 and 49, the civil war was going on the mainland, and the KMT was too busy with that. So it really just left the people on Taiwan very, very neglected and also heavily taxed. So that grew a lot of resentment. And what I wanted to get into was, I mean, for the longest time, people on Taiwan, Han people on Taiwan originated from southern Fujian and the Hakka people from Guangdong. Now, all of a sudden, you have people from all over mainland China coming to Taiwan. And the government of KMT officials were all like mainlanders from various provinces speaking like Tapalex and local languages that people here haven't really heard. And this was before Mandarinization, so Mandarin was not widespread yet. So it was harder to communicate, and there was mutual misunderstandings. A lot of the mainlanders mistrusted some of the Taiwanese because the Taiwanese were, I mean, they were Japanese subjects for 50 years, so their loyalties were questioned. So there is this is how they can paint these mainlanders as foreigners, because there was a cultural gap. But these cultural gaps existed all over China. It wasn't until China was more unified linguistically.
It's really the function of prior to the Japanese takeover, the primary group of people that come into Taiwan from mainland are basically from like three places, right? Zhangzhou, Quanzhou, and Eastern Guangdong, right? So these people, they maintain their cross-strait relationship with their cousins across the Taiwan Strait. But when in 1945, when a lot of the mainlander came with the KMT, those mainlander came from all over China. Like, and in the outside the traditional area of migration. So in other parts of China, yes, China is huge. China is a civilization. There's very different parts of China can have huge cultural differences. So these people from mainland China, they usually speak their own dialect, but to communicate with each other, they spoke standard Mandarin. Whereas the people already in Taiwan, they will speak Minnan, right, or Hakka, or, you know.
Honestly, during that time, a lot of the mainlanders spoke very broken standard Mandarin.
That's true.
A lot of them sounded kind of like you.
Well, many of them did come from my parts, from my Sichuan, yeah.
Which is why even though in Minnanhua or Hokkien, there is a difference between yin and yang, when we speak Mandarin in Taiwan, we don't really differentiate between the two, which is why when a lot of Taiwanese people speak Mandarin, we say 成功 and not 成功.
I can't hear the difference. It's all the same to me.
Yeah, because Southwesterners like you taught us wrong.
But yeah, I mean, that's...
And we also say 翁 instead of 翁 for the... Yeah, like 渔翁得利. Like we say, a lot of them people say 渔翁得利.
Well, that's also, hey, my people also brought the Taiwanese beef noodle, right?
Taiwan's beef noodle soup does have Taiwan's characteristics, but it's basically mainland cuisine that was invented in Taiwan. It's kind of like Korean style 炸酱面, or as they call it, 炸酱面, which was invented by Chinese migrants from Shandong. So like in Korea, it's considered Chinese cuisine, but back in China, it's considered Korean cuisine. The same applies for this beef noodle soup. It's like on the mainland, there is this Taiwanese-style beef noodle soup. But in Taiwan, this beef noodle soup is kind of basically considered stuff that was brought over by mainlanders. Because you had a lot of soldiers from the mainland. They came here. They were promised, within 5 years, they'll go back to the mainland. Never happened. And what they had to make a living, but there was no war that was actively being fought. So a lot of them ended up selling their hometown cuisines to people in Taiwan, and it really diversified the palate over here. Like local Taiwanese, like my grandmother, they don't really eat spicy. They don't eat beef. All of that changed within a generation or two. Now, speaking of the Civil War, another misrepresentation of, I guess, cross-strait relations in Chinese history is Taiwan started the Chinese Civil War. So do you want to shine a light on why this is such a ridiculous statement?
Well, I mean, what they meant to say is KMT started the Chinese Civil War. I mean, Taiwan was just one of the provinces that was under control by the KMT in 1945 at the time of the Japanese surrender.
And before then, it wasn't even under KMT control.
It was Japanese colony.
And this is related to the next often seen mischaracterization of Taiwan, which is that Taiwan's original separatists were Japanese who secretly stayed in Taiwan following Japan's surrender. But if you look into the history, you'll find that the KMT was very particular about who in Taiwan was a citizen of the ROC and who was not. If you were Japanese, you were out, unless you married into a local family, which, although did happen, was quite rare. So there was no significant Japanese population in Taiwan that was not repatriated in 1945. And honestly, back then, if you were Japanese, even if you were born and raised in Taiwan, you really wouldn't have blended in with actual locals for a number of reasons.
Because during the colonial period, the Japanese set themselves at the top of the social hierarchy. You know, they didn't try to assimilate into the local cultures. They're forcing the local to assimilate to the Japanese way.
Now, this misconception is based on something that's real, which I'll get into. But a while back, Jackson Hinkle said on a podcast, I think it was Propaganda & Co., that Taiwan separatism was designed by the U.S. deep state to maintain its geopolitical interests in the region. And although some people might find his explanation to be an oversimplification, it's actually true. And how it was done was existing contradictions in Taiwan were taken advantage of by U.S. foreign policymakers who before had no problem with Taiwan being a part of China, but were then interested in keeping Taiwan separate from the mainland after the communists won on the mainland. And one of the major contradictions at the time was the landed aristocracy that enjoyed quite a bit of power under the Japanese, but felt sidelined when the KMT arrived. For one, higher levels of government were held by elites from the mainland, elected in 1948, and weren't re-elected until the 1980s due to martial law. And on top of that, the KMT carried out land reform in Taiwan to build Taiwan's economy and prevent themselves from being driven out by a bunch of angry peasants like on the mainland. And they were able to do this because on Taiwan, their power came from the military and U.S. support. Whereas on the mainland, a huge part of their power came from the landed aristocracy there. So they could piss off Taiwan's huge landlords without any issue.
I think people, you know, maybe find hard to imagine how the landed aristocracy enjoyed benefit from Japanese colonialization, but this can have analogies in Chinese history. It's like when the Mongol conquest of China, I'm going back 1,000 years again, when the Mongol conquest of China happened, the Mongol ruler didn't really care about like nitty gritty of local administration. So they basically let the Han landlords kind of run the local affairs as they all see fit. But at the same time, the Mongols, they have their own strong cultural identity. So they refused to kind of assimilate into the Confucian worldview to assimilate into the Han culture. So it's kind of like they also set themselves at like the top of the social hierarchy. So on the grassroots level, the Han literatis, landed gentry, whatever, even though they kind of lost some political power by, you know, their traditional way of getting to the top via the imperial civil service exam. But at the local grassroots level, their power were unchecked as feudal lords, because the Mongols, they didn't bother to rebuild this kind of the centralized bureaucracy to administer at the local level. So the Han landlord's power actually grew during the Mongol rule. And so I guess that's kind of similar to what I'm guessing, what happened to the landed aristocracy.
Yeah, there were some similarities, especially during the beginning of Japan's colonization of Taiwan. Before the tail end, when they actively tried to assimilate Taiwan into Japan proper. But regardless, the landed aristocracy enjoyed quite a bit of power under Japan's rule. And to use mob terminology, they were kind of like kappa regimes while Japan was like the boss. And they weren't too thrilled when the KMT took away their kappa regime powers. And the US recognized that a lot of the landed aristocracy had loyalties to Japan for this reason, and that certain factions in Japan wanted to maintain their foothold in Taiwan. And that these forces had created a provisional government of the Republic of Taiwan in Japan that curiously had more Japanese people in it than Taiwanese. So the US decided to covertly support them while overtly supporting Chiang Kai-shek, so they had controlled opposition against Chiang. Because you gotta realize, Chiang Kai-shek was not the preferred puppet in Taiwan, and the US in fact tried to oust him a few times. It's just, Chiang Kai-shek was very good at setting up situations where he was the only viable choice to get the job done. So the US reluctantly supported him while they weren't particularly happy with the fact that he had many ideas of his own and he refused to formalize a two-China situation and he kept telling the US that his affairs with the mainland were domestic. So the US supported separatism as leverage against him, and in fact, publicly supporting Taiwan separatism back then would land you in jail, and this was the case all the way up until the 1980s, which is why up until then, most separatists operated abroad, initially in Japan before shifting their base of operations to the US, which is how you now have organizations like FAPA, or the Formosan Association for Public Affairs. So as you can probably guess, Taiwan separatism was quite niche in Taiwan until the liberal opposition movement against the KMT gained momentum in the 1980s. And when martial law and the ban on opposition parties were lifted, these separatists that worked abroad came back to Taiwan and began working their way into centers of power. But even in 2000, when the first DPP leader, Chen Shui-bian, was elected, the DPP being the Democratic Progressive Party, which is the liberal opposition party against the KMT with separatist leanings. It's the current incumbent party of Tsai Ing-wen and Lai Ching-te. Anyways, Chen Shui-bian, the first DPP leader, he had to ensure his constituents during his inauguration that he would not make moves towards Taiwan independence or abolish the National Reunification Program, though he did do the latter. And it wasn't until his leadership from 2000 to 2008 that Taiwan's curriculum was altered in a top-down fashion to de-emphasize Chinese history and focus more on Taiwan in a way that implied Taiwan was separate from the rest of China, thus grooming a new generation of Taiwanese youth who do not see themselves as Chinese. So evidently, there's quite a bit of social engineering that's not as grassroots as separatists want you to believe.
So having said that, why didn't the follow-on KMT government led by Ma Ying-jeou reverse the kind of the de-Sinification campaign in the education arena? Like Ma Ying-jeou had a chance to undo what Chen Shui-bian has done, right? Like many people demanded that he kind of reverse the de-Sinification campaign that was carried out in arena of education and media, but Ma Ying-jeou didn't do any of that. Why was that?
The KMT was elected in 2008 mostly because of Chen Shui-bian's corruption that made the DPP very unpopular. And the KMT is a shell of its former self, with its glory days being the Bonapartist Jiang Jingguo era between the Chiang Kai-shek and liberal Li Donghui eras. So it's a party without much of an identity, trying to fit in a liberal democracy, and it's worried about losing centrist voters. So today it pays lip service to being anti-separatist, while also appeasing the separatists for votes. So it tries to make everyone happy while ultimately making nobody happy.
Kind of like the DNC, kind of like the Democratic Party establishment in US. I mean, they have been moving towards the center since the Clinton era. and which really means they're just moving steadily towards the right.
Or it's, you can argue that it's like the Republican Party. Like, they'll argue about how the moral fabric of society is degenerating under Democrat rule, but then when they're in power, they don't really do much to try to fix problems like the normalization of a bunch of young women being turned out on OnlyFans because the economy is in such a sad state, for example.
Yeah, they don't really care about that. Those are just divide and rule politics that they use to gain votes. But they don't actually care. They're just an excuse to gain votes. They don't really care about those things.
These are all issues, like everything on this list are things that we'll have dedicated episodes about to really get into the nitty-gritty and the meat and potatoes. And I guess another misconception is Taiwan is recognized as an independent country by 12 countries. I want to get into why that is a misrepresentation of facts.
Well, they're being recognized as the government of the Republic of China. And those 12 nations don't simultaneously have relationship with the PRC, with the People's Republic of China. Because, you know, basically you can recognize either only one. Ostensibly, they function under the One China framework. and both sides claim to be the sole legitimate government of all of China. There's only one, like the Highlanders. There's only one. You can only recognize one.
It's just a little bit more complicated on the Taiwanese side, since there are separatist leading politicians and government who do not want to acknowledge how the laws of the very government they serve abide by this framework as well. Not to mention, you can't recognize Taiwan as an independent country when you have diplomatic ties with Taipei, considering that Taipei does not recognize Taiwan as an independent country.
Because Taiwan has never declared independence. It's simple.
Well, when you say that, people might mention how there was a short-lived Republic of Taiwan, or I think in English it's translated as Republic of Formosa, that was declared in 1895 by Qing loyalists who did not want to fall under Japanese rule when China was forced to give Taiwan to Japan.
That's almost irrelevant. The Republic of Taiwan that happened after the Qing defeat by the Japanese, that was created because the people on Taiwan, they didn't want to be a Japanese colony. So they wanted to retain their ties with China, but because China was forced to cede Taiwan to Japan, so they decided to declare independence so that they will not be a Japanese colony, and they call themselves Republic of Taiwan. But everybody who served in the Republic of Taiwan, they're all like former Qing officials, former Qing government officials on Taiwan.
They were brutally massacred by the Japanese.
And they adopted era name like any Chinese imperial dynasty, and their era name is Yongqin, which means forever Qing, which shows where they're who they're inclined toward.
Another thing that people will say is, well, at first Taiwanese people said we are the real China and wanted to reunify with the mainland under ROC rule, but then decided they wanted to be independent. I guess we kind of went into that earlier. Things aren't really that simple. You're kind of just mishmashing all the different powers at play in cross-strait relations into one. I guess broadly speaking, though, the popular sentiment during my mom's generation, it wasn't Taiwan is the real China. It's the Republic of China is the legitimate government of China. And one day we will liberate the mainland, and we do want to see reunification. That was a popular sentiment, but by the 1980s, most people knew it was never going to happen. But it was impolite to publicly say that. It's kind of like how today most people know separatism isn't going to happen, but people won't be too happy if you publicly say it loudly. So it's one of those things that everyone knows, but they just don't say. That's more realistic.
That's like recently that the Taiwan internet celebrity who was, you know, more pro-separatist, he went over to mainland China and he was like, oh my God, you know, China is actually pretty nice. It's a pretty nice place. And then suddenly he got attacked by all the trolls, the pro-separatist trolls, his former base in Taiwan for being like a CCP shill or something. And I think it's also stemmed from a lot of ignorance because, you know, this is not just Taiwan, this is also Hong Kong. A lot of youth, maybe they didn't have a chance to be exposed to the real mainland China. So their idea of mainland China is what they receive via their very heavily propagandized media. All right, I mean, say similar to to American public. You know, their idea of China is this force-fed idea of China that's served up by, you know, Wall Street journals, Bloomberg, and CNN, and it has no relationship. Yeah, has no relationship with real China. You know, that this is the reason I think why the Chinese government right now, they're extending visa-free policy to all like major European countries, because they know if they let people come and see for themselves, all the propaganda will just kind of fall away. I hope they do that for Americans. I don't know if they will, but at least that will allow a lot of American tourists who are curious to explore and to see for themselves what mainland China is really like.
Yeah, definitely. I'm all for genuine cultural exchange, which is why I started this podcast. And moving along, I think another great misconception we have about Taiwan is this portrayal of mainlanders who arrived to Taiwan in 1949 as a bunch of anti-China reactionaries. And I think this view is very insensitive as well as oversimplified when the vast majority of those who arrived were soldiers who were promised by the KMT that they'd be home very soon. And these soldiers were in the army for a variety of reasons. I mean, some joined during the Second Sino-Japanese War to fight the Japanese. Others joined whatever army they could so they could get fed. And a lot of them, and this isn't mentioned enough, a lot of them were actually teenagers impressed into the army against their will.
Yeah, a lot of them were press gang like at the last minute, like in 1949, just before KMT left mainland. They're trying to, recruit as many people as they want. They even evacuated whole islands off the Chinese coast and moved them, forcibly relocated them to Taiwan. So a lot of people who migrated, they didn't really have a choice. They just, you know, they just got caught up in the big historical tide.
Imagine if you were a little boy and you were sent by your family to buy groceries, and on your way you were impressed into the army, and then you're put on a boat and sent to Taiwan, and you're being promised every year, hey, pretty soon we're going to 反攻大陆, we're going to reclaim the mainland, we're going back and we're going to liberate our mainland compatriots. And up until the late 1980s, you don't have a chance to go back. You're not allowed to go back, and your parents are either really old or dead by then. And you may be separated from your wife or your siblings for decades. And you start a new family on Taiwan while feeling like you're betraying both of your families, like the one on the mainland, and you're hiding something from your family in Taiwan. It's a huge tragedy for a lot of people caught up in this very unfortunate situation, and to just paint them as a bunch of crooks who didn't love their country enough. When in reality, after the mainland's reforms and opening up, these people sent a lot of money back to their original communities. And you have some people drawing comparisons with counter-revolutionaries escaping Cuba to the US. But even among Cuban immigrants, you don't know all of their stories, not to mention their situation is very different from the situation between China's mainland and Taiwan.
Especially the Cuban immigrants who came over after Castro lifted the restrictions, in the 1980s. Most of the people who came just economic migrants, basically, to the United States.
Yeah, to make these sweeping statements, oh, you're from Taiwan, your family escaped communism and didn't love China enough.
That's kind of reductionist, you know. My own family, my grandpa on both sides, they're all from like landlord class. But that doesn't mean like I want to restoration of the feudal regimes in China.
Not to mention, only like 15% of Taiwan's population descend from that wave of migration. It's like, bitch, please. My family's been in Taiwan long before there ever was a KMT or CPC.
Or communism. You guys, they were there way before Karl Marx was born.
Yeah, and it also predates earlier iterations of communism or socialism, what Marx and Engels refer to as utopian socialism, such as Owenism. Anyways, last misconception on today's list, then we'll wrap up this episode, which is the U.S. only began recognizing Taiwan as a part of China in 1979. Now, I think this one is interesting because when World War II ended, like I said before, the U.S. didn't question whether or not Taiwan was a part of China. But when the writing was on the wall that the KMT was going to lose the mainland, the U.S. began to come up with ways to keep Taiwan separate from the rest of China and even entertain the idea of giving Taiwan back to its former colonizer, Japan. What the U.S. ended up doing, though, was, as we said earlier, pay lip service to Chiang Kai-shek claiming his so-called Republic of China to be the legitimate government of China, you know, calling it free China. But it also undermined Chiang Kai-shek's claims when in 1950, the U.S. purposely excluded China from the Treaty of San Francisco when the final peace settlements were made with Japan, so they could make the argument that Japan only surrendered Taiwan and that Taiwan's status is undetermined, and Chiang Kai-shek was only given authority to govern it until final arrangements were made. This is what separatists call the theory of Taiwan's undetermined status, and it was an attempt at creating legal justification for not recognizing Taiwan as a part of China, or to create two Chinas. But when diplomatic ties were formed with the PRC, the US had to recognize the One China policy, which states in no uncertain terms that the PRC is the successor state of the ROC, and therefore the sole legitimate government of all of China, and that Taiwan is a part of China, therefore effectively nullifying the theory of Taiwan's undetermined status. Though, what the US does today is, it holds the position that it only acknowledges the PRC's position, but doesn't necessarily agree with or recognize it.
It's funny how that worked out, because a lot of the current disputes that's been weaponized by United States against China, whether it's in the Taiwan Strait or in South China Sea, it all stems from U.S. excluding China from attending the Treaty of San Francisco to be part of that settlement. And so that left questions of sovereignty over these areas. And now U.S. is able to weaponize these disputes against China and say, this is Chinese aggression, whatever. To summarize it, the Taiwan issue itself is a legacy of the Chinese Civil War, that created this unfortunate divide among the Chinese people across the Taiwan Strait. But U.S. is the one that's trying to weaponize this issue in its geopolitical struggle against China.
The way I summarize it is that Taiwan is plagued by many layers of contradictions and antagonisms, resulting from 50 years of Japanese colonization, the mishandling of contradictions among the people by the KMT dictatorship, mutual misunderstandings between Ben Shengren and Wai Shengren in the previous generations, and on top of all of this, a global elite and U.S. ruling class willing to exploit all of these contradictions for its own gain at the expense of the Chinese people on both sides of the strait, and especially among the people on Taiwan. A lot of people think since Taiwan is such a small island, it can't be that significant, and that China is making a big deal out of all of this for no reason. But if it's so insignificant, how come the Dutch wanted it? Why did the Spanish want it? Why did the Japanese want it? And why is the U.S. so interested in maintaining its influence over the island and actively preventing reunification, despite promising the encouragement of peaceful reunification? So let's get into why the Dutch wanted it. They wanted it because of its proximity to the Dutch East Indies and mainland China, making it the ideal trading post for conducting trade with China. The Spanish wanted it for the same reason, due to its proximity to the Spanish-occupied Philippines, and the Japanese wanted it because it's a springboard for launching an invasion into the Chinese mainland and southward into the Pacific Islands and Southeast Asia, which Japan wanted to do to expand its empire. So as we can see, Taiwan is a gateway between the Pacific and the Asian continent, and if you read Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, U.S. policy is to maintain presence on the periphery of the Eurasian continent to prevent the rise of a Eurasian counter-hegemony capable of challenging U.S. hegemony. And his worst nightmare is starting to come true, which is a China and Russia united not necessarily out of ideology like during the short-lived era of Sino-Soviet friendship, but out of common geopolitical interests.
And Iran. So, if you map it out on a map, that's like the majority of Eurasia right there. Restoration of the Mongol Empire. Right now, if you look at the language, a lot of the national security elite in U.S., when they talk about Taiwan, they're more blatant about it. They say, if we lose Taiwan to China, right? And they're talking like Taiwan is a property of the United States. They don't even make pretension about how it's an independent country or state or whatever. They say, if we lose Taiwan to China.
It's kind of like how they talked after the communists won the Chinese Civil War. They were basically like, oh, we lost China. As if China was something for them to lose.
Yeah.
Why I wanted to start this podcast was also because people have this tendency to attribute everything on the island to Chiang Kai-shek, when arguably I would say his son Jiang Jingguo and then his son's successor Li Donghui have a far greater influence on modern-day Taiwan than Chiang Kai-shek did. I mean, Chiang Kai-shek died 50 years ago.
I think our role here is just to educate, right? There's so much ignorance. We're just trying to spread more general knowledge about Taiwan so people are not easily misled and being swayed by, you know, State Department propaganda.
And finally, the false dichotomy I really hope to shatter is this notion that to love Taiwan means to hate China and to love China means to hate Taiwan, which you see on both the pro and anti-China sides among foreigners, especially with those loser expat YouTubers in Taiwan working here as third-rate English teachers whose fake love of Taiwan is premised on their hatred of mainland China. And if you think about it, even if you don't agree that we're politically Chinese, we're culturally Chinese, so all
we're the same people.
Yeah, so all it takes for these people's so-called love for Taiwan to go away is for popular opinion on Taiwan to shift towards questioning Western hegemony and embracing the idea of reconciliation and eventually reunification with the mainland. I really want to reiterate, I arrived at my pro-reunification views not out of hatred of Taiwan or its people, but the exact opposite. It's because I want to see Taiwan do well and thrive with dignity, and I want to see people's lives and future generations only get better here. If I hated Taiwan and loved China, why would I want Taiwan to be a part of China? That's like saying I hate somebody but want him to move in with me. You know, Taiwan is much more than the KMT or the DPP, anti-communism or separatism. And if you claim to support China, you owe it to yourself to understand this part of China that's been a part of Chinese civilization for far longer than any of these conflicts have existed and will continue to exist as a part of Chinese civilization long after these conflicts have settled.
Yeah, ultimately, people across the Taiwan Strait, we're the same people. But we're from the same culture. And so it's kind of ridiculous to say, oh, I love this side. I love this side of the strait versus this side. I love the culture on Taiwan. It's so unique. It's like, it's better than the culture on mainland China. Then, dude, it's the same culture, man. Just relax.
Well, I think what people like to do is they'll take like some very local customs over here and then compare them to, say, some local cultures in Harbin and be like, oh, see, it's so different. But of course it's different because China has so many different local cultures. Now, if you look at Xiamen, which is right across the street, it's like 99.9% the same, like these local customs. Yeah, I think we had a very good conversation today. And I have a feeling that you'll be on more in the future. So how can our listeners follow your work?
As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I have a Twitter account, Carl Zha. If you like my shit post, go follow me there. And I have a YouTube channel, Carl Zha, just on YouTube, where I talk everything about China. I maintain another podcast, the Silk and Steel podcast, on Patreon. So just go to patreon.com, search for Silk. The first result is my podcast, which talks about everything about China, history, culture, politics. And thanks for inviting me, Xiangyu. Inviting me anytime. I love to talk.
Right. And I will provide the links that you gave in the show notes so people can find them.
Awesome.
Yeah, so bye for now and talk to you soon. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode of Straight Talk and are looking forward to what's in store. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share with friends who want to learn more about the topics covered by this podcast. If you have any feedback or want to suggest show topics that fit the theme of this podcast, please feel free to send an email to straighttalk@xiangyu.tw. That is straighttalk@xiangyu.tw. I'd like to give a huge thank you to my upper-level patrons, Alvin, Mecha Patriot, Yi Jing, and Pranav. Finally, if you like what I'm doing and want to support me sharing a perspective on Taiwan and beyond that's not covered by mainstream media, please consider becoming a patron on my Patreon or making a contribution to any of the links in the show notes. I got some exciting episodes coming up, so be sure to stay tuned. See you guys in the next episode.
人情。